Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 40 of Season 10 of Movie Our Minute, the daily podcast, where we hijack our way through the 1974 action thriller, The Taking of Pelham 123, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again to finish off the week is Andy Golding of both Blueprint Review and the Spoiler Podcast. Welcome back to the show once again, Andy.
Good to be back one final time, Rob, and one final time we'll be hijacking the podcast at some point during the show with the words, "I'm taking your train."
All right. I look forward to that. it's been fun all week as you've done that, so that's fine.
It got less scary as it went on.
Exactly. You haven't caused as much damage and destruction as I had feared. So. I'm quite glad. All right, so minute 40 begins with Blue wanting an update, and ends with Garber telling off Frank. So we ended things yesterday with Frank starting to get a little bit on Garber's nerves, a little bit, just in the background, you know, as they're talking over one another. And things like that, but you know, they have an interesting rapport, as we said yesterday, and that will continue into today. But you know, Garber's trying to get in touch with Blue, and he finally gets a response at the end of yesterday's episode, where Blue does respond to him, and then Blue starts by saying, "Okay, any news to report?" He goes, "What's that about news? Say again about news." I said, "Have you any news to report?" "Oh, no, nothing yet." And then we hear Green sneezing in the background. And then you get the first opportunity in this movie to hear someone say Gesundheit.
Yes, I was so happy to hear that sneeze. I was so happy I got one in there, because I know everyone loves the big sneeze at the end. And that brilliant final look from.
Well, the best part at the end is the musical note, you know, after he sneezes.
And yeah, but I love the look he gives. I know we're not doing that scene, yeah. But the look, there was a film critic called John Simon, who described Walter Matthau as looking like a half-melted rubber bulldog. And that's the image, when I hear that quote, that's the image that I think of.
That's great. And then Blue looks back and goes, he says to him, what are you calling about? And he goes, "Pelham, we need more time." And he actually does something very interesting here. Blue then turns to Green and says, "Shut the door, please." Which, it's so telling, again, about the personality of Blue. You know, that he doesn't want to alarm anyone on the train as to what his intentions are here. He wants as much privacy as he can get. So just close the door. And then he goes, "It's 2:24, Lieutenant. You've got 49 minutes left. Be reasonable, will you? We're trying to cooperate with you, but we can't do anything if you don't give us enough time to work with." And then Blue goes, "49 minutes. Because we're dealing with City Hall, for God's sakes. You know what a mess of red tape that is?" 49 minutes. "Look, fella, we know how to tell time here, as well as you do. But we aren't going to get any place if all you do is repeat 49 minutes. 48 minutes.
It's such a good exchange that I love it.
Yes, yes. And we know that a minute has not passed. But okay.
Yeah.
We're willing to suspend a little bit of disbelief that maybe it was in the middle of 49 minutes at the time, and therefore, you know, he's still, by the time, you know, it takes him 45 seconds to get to the point where he says 48 minutes. So okay, they'd been 15 seconds in and now it changed. So, and then Garber goes, yeah, all right. We'll get back to you as soon as we can. And then Frank from the peanut gallery screams, "Christ, To hear you plead with that chicken makes me ashamed to be an American. He goes, Frank, go play with your train. which is a great line. I really like the way that he delivers it also.
He's trying
to be as cordial as possible, but just throws that out there. Go, I'll play with your trains.
Thinking about how we were saying in one of the earlier episodes, how Blue generally doesn't seem to want to kill anyone. He thinks that he's got this worked out in a way that he won't have to. But clearly the deadline he's given him is unrealistic. I don't think they could possibly get the money to him in that amount of time. And yet he can't back down from that because he can't look like he's given any wiggle room. So has he made a miscalculation? Or does he think that one hostage is going to be expendable?
I think he's it first of all, it's a great question. I believe that he doesn't want to get to the point where he needs to be violent, but he realizes also that he doesn't have a choice. You know, in order to show them that he means business. I mean, we'll talk in the next few weeks, about who he chooses as the first victim and why and things like that. But I think at this point he's still hoping that they're going to be reasonable and that they can pay the ransom. But I think you're right. I think he's miscalculated the time aspect of it.
Yeah, I think so, because it does seem unrealistic. There's a lot that I suppose there's a lot to factor in, isn't there? And it's whether he is if he is working for someone, has he been tasked with planning all the intricacies, or has he been handed that plan?
And that could be also that maybe he doesn't have a choice.
Yeah.
You know, that he was told this is what we're doing. You know,
I think it's vague enough that it's like those questions are left hanging, and it works in favor of the film. I think it's not a nitpick. It's a bit of color.
Yeah. An hour is. Like nowadays, if you know a movie was being done like this and they said we need it within an hour, also would be very unrealistic. But maybe back in the 70s, that made a little more sense.
Yeah.
You know, because again, they're only asking for $1 million. You know. So you know, it's a good thing that damn, I just lost that train of thought that I was.
you've lost a train. It's thematically appropriate.
Yes. It made me think of Austin Powers, you know, where again he says $1 million and everyone laughs at him. $1 million? Okay, no big deal. So he mentions the idea of red tape. What's the difference of what color the tape is?
I'm sure I've seen an explanation about red tape on an episode of The West Wing. It is something to do with what was used to bind up documents. I can't remember it exactly, but I remember seeing it on The West Wing.
Okay, first of all, you are correct about that.
Yeah.
Yes. The idea of red tape originated in the early 16th century with the Spanish administration of Charles V, who was king of Spain and the Holy Roman Emperor, and he used red tape in an effort to modernize the administration that was running his vast empire. The red tape was used to bind the most important administrative dossiers that required immediate discussion by the Council of State and separate them from files that were treated in an ordinary administrative way, which were bound with ordinary string.
That's interesting, though, because that's the most important document to a band up in red tape.
Right, and nowadays
Rather than...
getting through red tape is something completely different.
Yes.
Yes, in the novel David Copperfield, Sir Charles Dickens spoke of red tape. The quote is, "Britannia, that unfortunate female, is always before me, like a trussed fowl, skewered through and through with office pens and bound hand and foot with red tape." Which again, they bound documents and official papers with red tape. So yeah, it's just very interesting, how that evolved, into the phrase that we know of nowadays about red. Maybe just red tape means important laws and important bureaucratic ways of looking at things. I don't know. I mean, during the U.S. Civil War, they used red tape to tie together the personal records of veterans, making it inconvenient to actually get to them. President Warren Harding in 1921 referenced the use of red tape, and because he said that his goal once becoming president would be to remove red tape and technicalities from the management of the department's economics resources to combat stagnation. And he later on said that when he appointed someone as the governor of Alaska, he says that he appointing him to unravel government red tape. But yeah, it's just it's interesting where it made the jump, from being something that seemed positive to now something negative. No idea. Absolutely no idea about where that jump made, because everything I'm seeing just talks about the idea of excessive and complicated procedures, unnecessary paperwork, approval bottlenecks, hindering decision making, things like that. All right, here's the answer. So in the 16th century, it was originally used for the most important things. In the 18th century, they started using red tape to try and slow tedious administrative processes.
Okay. So it was deliberately used in that way.
Yes, that's right. Over the years, the idea is that it maybe it was a way of trying to get back at the at monarchs that wanted to use it for good reasons, and they said, "Hey, we're going to change that. We're going to, give a more negative connotation to it," things like that. Don't know. Not really sure, but where that origin changes. So with the joke of Garber telling Frank to go play with his trains, that's where this minute ends. So, Andy, did you have anything else you want to say about either this minute or the movie in general?
I don't think so, other than I love it and I'm so glad that you invited me to come and talk about it because it's been so much fun.
I'm glad. I agree completely. Absolutely. All right. So every Friday we have a segment called Fun City Friday, where my guest will give a list of their top five movies that are somehow feature New York, because one of the obscure nicknames of New York is Fun City.
Okay.
So once again, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up, unless you're
Okay, well,
hijacking.
I'm hijacking. I'm taking your train, but I will start with my number five. What I've done, so As I was saying on an earlier episode, when I came to make my Robert Shaw list, I struggled a bit. I had to watch lots of other films that I'd never seen before to manage to get up to five. When it came to this one, I believe it was Jay Clewitt earlier in this series said, "This is a ridiculous thing to ask someone to do, but yeah, there are top five New York films." Because when I started looking it up, there's so many and so many brilliant ones. I put this was one that I didn't even hesitate. I put together a top five straight away. I found five films that I think are brilliant. So I'll do my official one first, but then I've got a second list of five, which is sort of a reaction against that. So this is the official one that we'll score points for. So my number five is Do the Right Thing. I've always loved Do the Right Thing. I think it's a brilliant film. I think it should have won the Best Picture for its year. And it's just got a real brilliant New York independent feel to it. Number four is Alexander McKendrick's Sweet Smell of Success. I think it's a brilliant film, really. Really well written, really well performed. I've never been a big Tony Curtis fan, but I think he's fantastic in Sweet Smell of Success.
Yeah,
And I think
I
Alexander.
saw that by accident years ago, and I really liked it.
Yeah, no, oh, it's a brilliant film. I think it's impressive that Alexander McKendrick came from the Ealing comedies background and made that jump to direct a brilliant New York film. Number three. I've gone with Billy Wilder's The Apartment. I love Billy Wilder, and I think this is his best film. And it's got that Walter Matthau connection through Jack Lemmon, who is also brilliant in it. Number two, I've gone Sydney Lumet's Dog Day Afternoon. I think it's a very popular choice, but I don't think it really needs justifying. I think it's an excellent, excellent film.
You're actually
And
the first person to use that. So.
I'm the first person to pick Dog Day Afternoon. Stan, I mean, it's the New York list, isn't it? There's so many to choose from. And my number one is a film that I've always loved and always meant a lot to me. It's Annie Hall. I grew up loving Woody Allen. I know he's a controversial figure nowadays, but I love Annie Hall. And I love its depiction of New York. I struggle more with Manhattan these days, but I think Annie Hall, I'd still 100% love. So I was looking at my list, and I noticed that they're all directed by men, and I thought it'd be interesting to see if I can come up with a list of New York from a woman's perspective, just all female directors. And I actually had to pare it down. There's loads of great New York films directed by female directors.
Oh,
So
wow.
this is my top five by female directors. Number five is Nicole Halofcena's debut film, Walking and Talking. I think he's a great little 90s indie film. Number four is a lesser-known indie film from the 70s, but one that I really love, called Girlfriends by Claudia Weill. It's a really good film, that Girlfriends. Number three is the Lizzie Borden's experimental indie film, Born in Flames, from 1983. It's in like a near future New York after the Social Democratic War of Liberation has taken place, and it's a really interesting film. I think this last Sight and Sound top 250 list, it made it onto the list, which I was really pleased about. In fact, I think it tied with a lot of films, but I think it was tied with Annie Hall, interestingly enough. The two great New York films there. Number two is the It's a documentary, Jenny Livingston's Paris is Burning, which was about the New York drag scene. A great documentary. My number one, it's maybe a bit of a sentimental choice, because this was a film I grew up loving, but I think its depiction of New York through a child's sort of viewpoint is great. It's Penny Marshall's Big, which is, I think, I love the way it's seen through. It shows New York through Tom Hanks as a little boy's eyes, and it shows it as terrifying and magical. So
Excellent.
that's my female director's New York list. And that is my final hijacking. I'm getting out of the hijacking game now. If you see fit to have me back, I promise I'll let you take the wheel for the whole thing.
No, feel free to hijack whenever you want. You're invited to hijack. Excellent. All right. And once again, we obviously also still have one final game of Name That Remake.
Okay.
So now we will spin the wheel and see what movie comes up for the final game with Andy for this week. And the wheel goes around and around and around and around, and let's see where it's going to stop. Okay, the original movie came out in 1944, and the remake came out in 1993. All right, and the synopsis is a group of survivors from a submarine attack must try and decide what to do when they discover that one of them is actually the enemy.
Submarine films. Can you repeat the synopsis again?
A group of survivors from a submarine attack must try and decide what to do when they discover that one of them is actually the enemy.
Yes, a submarine attack. Survivors from a submarine attack. I don't know. Has this been remade? It's not Lifeboat, is it?
Yes, it is.
Oh, I didn't realize that was a remake of Lifeboat.
Yes, it was remade as Life Pod in 1993. So it's set in space.
Oh, wow, really? Have you seen Life Pod?
Yeah. If I remember correctly, it was terrible.
Yeah.
But you could have guessed that already. You didn't need you didn't need me to tell you that. You didn't need me to confirm it. It's got a great cast because it's got Robert Loggia. Loggia. Oh. Whatever. Which he's always fun in movies.
Yeah. Well, my number one choice on my female New York list, Robert Loggia dancing on the piano in Big.
That's right. That's right. So here the IMDb synopsis of Life Pod is: Life Pod chronicles the trip of eight passengers after the ship on which they were traveling blew up on Christmas Eve 2168. Immediately, people start dying. The passengers begin to investigate why the ship blew up and how it relates to them.
Interesting. I'll give it a miss, I think.
Wow, it was written by Jay Roach.
Some big names behind it, then.
Ron Silver is in it. CCH Pounder. Lisa Waltz is in it. Oh, wow. You know who Lisa Waltz is?
Lisa Waltz, it really name rings a bell. I'm not sure. Who is she?
She was in Brighton Beach Memoirs. She played the cousin, Nora.
Oh, I don't think I've seen that.
You ever seen Brighton Beach Memoirs? Oh, wow.
No.
That's a great Neil Simon play.
That's got to be mine.
Jonathan Silverman is great in the main role, but there's something else I saw her in. I can't remember what it is right now. And for some reason, I've always remembered her from some other movie. It was not Life Pod.
I'm just making a note. Brighton Beach Memoirs. That's going to be my homework.
I have absolutely no idea what movie it is that I'm thinking of besides that. Don't know. But you see, I saw her name and immediately I remember that she was in Brighton Beach Memoirs. So
yeah.
All right. So Andy, for one final time this season, do you want to tell people where they can find Andy Golding?
Yes, you can find every episode of my old podcast Spoiler at spoilerpodcast.podbean.com, and you can find my writings about film on blueprintreview.co.uk.
All right, excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movieroundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movieroundminute@movierob.com. Net. So Andy, thank you very much for joining me this week. This has been great. I've had a lot of
Yeah,
fun.
thank you for having me. I hope you have me back again sometime soon.
And I know that I should keep you away from 70s movie trivia.
No, I need to prove myself on it.
Ah, okay. Well, you can always let me know how you're doing on the couch. I'll trust whatever you tell me. Yeah, I got those all right away, of course. Yeah, I knew that. All right. So I will be back on Monday with a new guest, but until then, achoo.
Get some time.